we're really privileged tonight to have speaking with someone that's familiar face. He's been, I think, Rick, you're going to tell us a little bit about that. He's been down with the Philosophers Forum for quite some time since its inception. And so I still feel like a newbie because I've only been coming about 5 years now. But I'm going to hopefully, Fred's going to tell us a little bit about his history with the Philosophers Forum. As it says here, he is with the Southwestern Medical Center. He's a professor of cell biology in the Program of Ethics and Science, and tonight he's here to talk about his new book. So, Fred, feel free to say anything about yourself you'd like in the way of introduction.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming this evening to participate in the latest session of the Philosophers Forum. And I don't have a microphone. Can you hear me back there? Yeah? Okay. So I have to talk to medical students periodically, and so I've learned to project. And so I get... So this is actually the flyer from a talk I gave in 1988. Here. So some things have changed a lot. I had hair then. And also the hair was dark. But some things haven't changed at all. The Philosopher's Forum always has a new location. Right? And the price has always been $4. So it's sort of remarkable that some things change and some things stay the same. Now when I spoke in 1988, I was talking about a book that I had just published a few months earlier called The Scientific Attitude. And today I'm going to talk about a book that I published a few months ago called Everyday Practice of Science. And this book has two parts to it. The first part talks about, well, what is science? How does it happen? And what's the science knowledge production process? And the second part talks about, well, once you understand science and practice, what are the implications for science and society? And I talk about or write about integrity and human research and ultimately science and religion. So my approach to this is my website page. And so what I explain to people is that I spend my mornings doing science and my afternoons reflecting on what doing science means. Okay, and so that's what I'm going to talk about. And three things I want to accomplish. One is to replace the linear model of science with a more contextual model, and I'll explain what I mean by that. The second is to explain how the interplay between investigators leads to the objectivity in science. It's not in the individual, it's in the interplay between investigators. And then the third is to try to begin to reframe the discussion about science and religion, talking about both as practices and as practices then how do they relate to each other. So this is the linear model of science. The path from hypothesis discovery is a direct line guided by objectivity and logic. The world is waiting to be discovered. The facts are out there. We just have to collect them like postage stamp collecting. The method of science, the scientific method is used to make discoveries. And researchers are dispassionate and objective observers. So that's actually the way we teach about science. But this is what I call the Lasker model of science. Now, the Lasker Foundation gives out each year the awards for the best research in biomedical science that have gone on in previous years. One of my colleagues at the UT Southwestern, a guy named Joe Goldstein, who's a Nobel laureate, is the chair of the Lasker Committee. And this is what he wrote a couple of years ago when the prize went to Ralph Steinman. And so it's worth reading because it captures the opposite of the linear model of science. Joe writes, why were Ralph Steinmetz's early studies ignored, neglected, and denigrated? It's not clear what's right and what's wrong. The powerful force of long-standing dogma, there's a lot of dogma in science, made it easy for the community to brush aside Steinmetz's experiments and ideas. Fortunately, Steinmetz's passionate belief, okay, in his data and his unshakable self-confidence propelled him forward despite the criticisms of his colleagues. So that's the nature of science that we have to understand. How does that happen? And how is, why is, where do we get these ideas from about linear science? Well, actually, we learn about linear science in textbooks, which tell us what the facts are, without telling us anything about where they came from, and in scientific research papers, which I'm not going to talk about tonight, but I call short stories, because they too are reconstructions of what actually happened. We don't really put down what actually happened in our papers. What we do is we write our papers the way we would have done the experiments if we knew the answer in advance. So the plot of all scientific papers is the scientific method. That's what makes a good scientific paper, is that its plot is the scientific method. But if you want to know about the Plaster model of science, then you have to ask about everyday practice. So, everyday practice is about two conversations. One conversation is about the individual and the world that they're trying to study. Of course, that's an urban statement. They're not trying to study the whole world. It's just a little piece. But that's one of the conversations. And the other is between the individual and the community. And of course, the community is part of the world, so that also looks a little bit funny. But nonetheless, these are different kinds of conversations, because this is an interventionist, experimentalist conversation, and this is very much a social interaction. And this is what I call discovery, and this is what I call credibility. So we learn something new about the world. We think we've discovered something. We make a claim. We make a claim that then gets evaluated in a social context to find out if other people end up believing, you know, and think that what we say is correct. And these circles are interpretive. So that means that I'm always interpreting what I do in the context of what came before. And they're iterative in the sense that each time I think I know something new, it influences how I think about what I knew about before. Okay, so first we'll talk about discovery. Rather than linear, the path to discovery tends to be very ambiguous and convoluted. We fail a lot. And from an ethical point of view, one of the problems of science is that the pressure is very great. So why is discovery so hard? So the answer is, well, philosophers have told us, Plato in particular told us in the Dialogues. So in the Dialogues, Plato has Menos say to Socrates, how will you look for it, Socrates, when you do not know at all what it is? Now, if you think about that for a moment, if you know what something is and you find it, then you haven't discovered anything. Right? And if you don't know what it is you're looking for, then you won't know when you discover it. So Plato concludes that discovery, in the sense that we mean it, is impossible. It can't happen. And actually, he ends up with this very famous the very famous explanation for how discovery occurs. What he says is that, well, we don't ever discover anything. We remember what we forgot when we were born. Okay, which is, you know, I don't find that very attractive, personally. I spend all my time remembering what I forgot when I was born. So, the thing is that Plato thinks about discovery as an event, not a practice or a process. So as an event, he's right. It's one of them. So that's not discovery, or I didn't notice anything where. Well, then you can't. But if you can, as a process, well, it looks like one of them, but I'm not sure, or I've seen something, but I don't know what it is, I've never seen one before. Those are paths that lead into the possibility of discovery. So as a process, discovery then becomes possible, and it all depends on noticing. It really depends on noticing what one often is not looking for. Noticing is a very difficult thing to do. So this is the noticing test. So let me just say that this is a diagram of the apparatus that Melvin Calvin used to discover the process of photosynthesis, or to characterize it, work from which he got the Nobel Prize. Hidden in this diagram, there is a humorous element. And you are invited to look for this humorous element while I tell you about it and about this diagram and the presence of it. So the story is, and of course you don't have no clue what I mean by humorous element. So if you want to look, some people just don't even think it's worth looking. You have to guess what that might mean. So the story is that Calvin's postdoc, this is the story, theoretically, nobody knows for sure, inserted this in the apparatus, and nobody noticed for maybe 10 years. And so it got by Calvin, it got by the editors and the reviewers and everybody. But it's there, and I'm going to show it to you in a moment. Now, there's a very interesting thing will happen after I show it to you. And this is an important part of the discovery process. Right now, this is an open field for you to imagine whatever you want and to look for whatever you can imagine to look for. Once I show this to you, you won't be able to look at this image without seeing the humorous element. Because your prior knowledge determines what it is you can see and what it is you think it means, and I'll say more about that in a moment. So right now, though, this is kind of a virginal situation here, and everybody is invited, not to tell you, in a class of 100 medical students, maybe one, sometimes, when I talk about this, will notice this element. So the question is, anybody noticed? No. Well, as I said. So, right here, there is a guy fishing. And he's caught a fish. Now, I'm going to take this circle away. And I challenge you to look at that apparatus without seeing that guy fishing. You're never going to be able to look at that again. Everybody has a thought style. I learned about thought style reading this wonderful book by Ludwig Fleck called Genesis and Development of a Scientific Fact. And that thought style, you know, that idea of a thought style says that, well, understanding requires interpretation in the context of what you already know. And your previous knowledge and experience determines what you know and what you think it means and what you do about it. And noticing things one way means not noticing them another. When I talk to medical students about this or other students, I like to use these three gestalts because everybody knows that this is a smiley face. We all share that thought style. But everybody doesn't agree on what this is or what this is. More people agree on this. What do you think that is? Bowling ball. There you go. I'd say usually about 50-50 over the bowling ball. And this one is a lot harder. Yeah? Any opinions around them? Button. Some people think it's a target. Some people think it's a soccer ball. So that...
Cigarette butt.
Alright. So there are a lot of options.
Simple for an arrow approaching you.
There you go. Well, does that mean I'm going to get out of here? So it's amazing that everybody can recognize this. It means that there are elements of our thought style that we share, but other elements that are disparate. But we bring that thought style to our work, and it determines everything about what we do in science. It determines what we decide to study. So we have to decide, well, is the problem we're interested in unsolved? Is it worth solving? Can I do it? If I'm wrong on any of those things, it might not be good for my career in science, because in order to undertake studies, I have to invest in the research. I have to invest time, energy, and money. How can I be objective if I've decided at the beginning what it is I want to study? If I've decided at the beginning what I wanted to study, I already think that that's something worth studying, and I have an idea of what the answer might be. And so it's hard to let go. And the thought style determines the experimental design. I think I know what I'm studying. But in order to decide to study something, I have to decide what the answer might be like. So, if I think I'm going to study something that happens quickly, I might look in seconds or minutes, but probably not hours or days. But what happens then? What happens is that I only can see what happens in seconds or minutes, not hours or days. So that if the thing that I'm studying actually takes a long time, I'm not going to see it. So the thing about what Plato said, this is back to Plato's paradox, because in order to study something, we set up the conditions to optimize seeing what we think we might see. And therefore, most of the time, what we see is what we think we might see. And we don't normally get out of that box. Sometimes we do. And some of you have heard of the idea of falsifiability, the famous notion of Karl Popper, philosopher, which says that, you know, if it's a scientific statement, it should be falsifiable. Well, maybe. But since every experiment tests the hypothesis and the method for testing the hypothesis, then if it doesn't turn out the way you expect, it could be the hypothesis is wrong, or it could be the method is wrong. And therefore, one doesn't give up a good idea just because the data don't fit. Falsifiability is a commitment to the possibility of being wrong. But actually, falsifying something, if you don't want it falsified, is pretty hard to do. Now, one of the ways that we get out of this dilemma of always seeing what we're looking for is what the very famous molecular biologist named Max Delbruck called the principle of limited sloppiness. It's very important that you understand that Delbruck is not American. He's German. And his English is British. When we talk about sloppiness, we're thinking right away technical sloppiness. Somebody did something wrong technically or made a mistake. That's not what Delbruck means. What Delbruck means is that every experimental design is a little bit muddy. He means muddy sloppiness. And therefore, because it's a little bit muddy, we never are sure, even under the best circumstances, that we know exactly what it is that we're doing. And because of that, sometimes we have the opportunity for experimental results to emerge that we weren't looking for. So, here's an example. We start out with laboratory studies that suggest the test chemical UK92480 might be useful for treating angina. So after you do preclinical work on, and you get these animal studies and other studies, you have to test the safety of the drug. So Pfizer tests 92480 in people to determine its safety. And it seems to be safe, but some of the men who participate in the study report that they develop penile erections. So somebody who's looking at this data says, hey, maybe there should be a different clinical, a different outcome, a different endpoint than what we were thinking about originally. And Pfizer becomes, this drug becomes Pfizer's blockbuster Viagra. So what happened here? Well, the original question was, is the potential anti-angina drug UK92480 safe for use in humans? The unexpected observation is that men taking it develop erections. That means there's an unintended question that was asked. That unintended question was, is this drug a useful drug for treating penile dysfunction? That was not the question that was asked to begin with. If it had been the question that was asked to begin with, the same experiments would have been done. So the question has been switched because something different has been noticed. What it's like is like going to North Park Mall. And, you know, when you go to North Park, you can park it, and we'll go one of the big department stores, and then go back out to your car, and then drive around to another big department store. But if you walk from one department store to another, you might notice a sale going on that you didn't know about, go into that sale, buy something, and never get to the other department store. That happens all the time. Right. So that if you miss, you change direction. This is called abduction. This is a name that Charles Peirce gave to this kind of way of discovery. Normally we think about science as being deduction or induction, but what Peirce said was that abduction is the most exciting method of discovery. An unexpected fact C is noticed. But C would have been expected if A were the case. Therefore, there are grounds to investigate A. You start out investigating C, you notice this new fact or a new observation, and you all of a sudden switch problems. And so often that's the way that science actually progresses. And then the third thing about the thought style is that it determines the meaning of data. So when you are really sort of what I call the edge of discovery, it's not clear what data is. Data and experimental noise often appear to be more or less the same. So what counts for data one day may end up turning out to be something much different. So I'll just give you an example from my own research. So when I originally started my research in cell biology, I wanted to understand what holds us together. It's actually pretty interesting if you think about it. I mean, you know, why do our skin cells all hold together? And there are people who have diseases, when they get up, they leave their skin behind them, right? So what are the forces that hold us together? And so I started studying cell adhesion. And I was trained as an enzymologist, so I set up an experimental model in which I could study the sticking of cells as a function of time. So here you see the number of cells as a function of time. And I could use this quantitative assay as a way of learning more about the forces and the mechanisms involved in adhesion. I also took a picture. This is the first picture I ever took through a microscope. Any of you who have ever looked through a microscope will know right off that this picture is really bad. But I was trained as a biochemist, not as any kind of a microscopist. So I didn't know how to take pictures. And so what you see here are big pieces of dust, medium-sized pieces of dust, little pieces of dust, and occasionally cells that aren't in focus, but you can count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. You can count the number of cells. For me, data was the number of cells, not how they looked. So then I started teaching, this is when I first came to Dallas, teaching a course called histology, which is the microscopic analysis of all the cells and tissues in the body. And I had to learn about microscopy, and I had to learn about ideas of cell shape, size, staining, etc., as features that were worth noticing. And I did this experiment, and I said, I've learned some tremendous things here about adhesion, because these two are tremendously different. This one, the cells are round. This one, the cells are spread. And a lot of you might be looking at this and thinking to yourself, what is he talking about? I mean, you know, for the untrained eye, it might not be obvious. But to me, when I did this experiment, it was obvious. I realized that for the particular question I was asking, I was using the wrong methodology. I need to be studying shape, not number. And so once I knew that, I could learn how to do microscopy. Because if you're going to look at shape, you need to be able to treat the cells, take pictures, and do stuff so that you can see that. Now, I suggest that everybody in this room can see the difference between these and these, even if everybody can't see the difference between these and these. But it's the same thing. This is actually what you call heuristic data. I learned something. This is what you call demonstrative data. I worked it out so that everybody else might believe what I have to say to them about the discovery that I think that they made. So what happened? In 5 years, I switched. At the beginning of the five-year period, all data was quantitative. I didn't care about cell size or shape or appearance. At the end of the 5 years, all data started being cell shape, and I didn't care about number, except that if there were too many cells, it was hard to see the shape. Now, if you go back to that original picture I showed you 5 years earlier, and you use your imagination, you can see that these cells have changed shape compared to these cells. But I didn't notice. Or if I noticed, it didn't make a difference. I didn't make it a problem for study. Okay, so I call this the Matthew version of discovery. Each of us who's doing research has a block of reality, just like Michelangelo would start out with a block of marble. We look at that block of reality and we think we know it's there. And we think we know what tools we need to get rid of all of the excess stuff in order to see it. And we're going to be like Plato, actually, most of the time. We're going to find what we're looking for. Michelangelo looked at that block of marble and he knew what statue was there. And this is why he did St. Matthew, to show that St. Matthew was buried in that marble. And sometimes what happens is we use a new tool, or we get a new student to help us out, or a new postdoc, or something interesting happens, and we get an opportunity to notice something that we weren't looking for. So then it becomes very exciting. So then what happens? Well, science is like art in the sense that this sense of creativity. But it's not like art in the sense of what happens next. Because an artist, if they want, can be satisfied with what they've done. They can say, this is my existential relationship with the universe. If you don't like it, too bad. But a scientist can't say that, because it's not science unless other people agree with what you think. So a scientist can do no more than proto-science. And then they have to turn to the community in order to establish the credibility of the work. And the objectivity becomes the goal of that interaction. So here's the problem of subjectivity. It's one of my favorite René Magritte pictures, The False Mirror. It's not much. No matter how much individuals try to be objective, they're not really able to be so. When we look out, we don't really see things as a reflection of how they are. We interpret them. So that was that we always may be subject to illusion or self-deception. That's why we have to turn outwards. We have to turn to other people. We have to ask for this notion of intersubjectivity. If I can see it, you can see it too, like those cells that I showed you. You weren't so sure that maybe if you looked at it when I showed you the one that was heuristic, but I wanted to show you the one that's demonstrative. If you couldn't see it, I got a problem, right? So what happens is that I make my discovery claims, or scientists make their discovery claims public, and that invites others to try to do the same thing. It's an invitation. It says that if I'm right, you can do it too. If we change positions, we're going to each be able to see. But here's the problem. another Magritte picture called Perspicacity. You see the artist is sitting here looking at an egg, and he's painting a bird in full flight. Okay? And Albert St. George says, discovery is seeing what everybody else has seen and thinking what nobody else has thought. Well, what happens when you seek to present your discovery claims to the community and you tell them what you have seen that they've never thought? They say, you're wrong. Okay, they're skeptical. They don't believe you. So the whole idea of novelty, especially a lot of novelty, really challenges intersubjectivity. It can lead to rejection. Science then becoming successful requires passion, just like back in the Lasker description. When the community says, you can't be right, it can't be important. If you really believe in yourself and what you've done, you have to become a passionate advocate. But you could be wrong. So there's only one thing worse than being wrong in science, and that's being ignored. And very often, the first leads to the second. So, okay, and so here are just some examples of things that began all seeming the same way. Cold fusion, N-waste, poly water, prions, ribosomes, shrimp. Nobody thought they were important, or they didn't believe it at all when they first happened. But some of these things, like RNA enzymes, or prions, which are like viruses, except they're made, they don't have any nucleic acid content, or transposable elements, which were believed but thought to be irrelevant, became Nobel Prize winning research, whereas cold fusion and rays and polywater became part of the history of mistaken science. And there's no way of telling at the beginning. So credibility happens to a discovery claim. The discovery becomes credible, is made credible by events. This is what William James' way of talking about pragmatism's description of the way things are. And where we're headed is what Annette Baer calls the commons of the mind. It's not only that we reason about the way things are and challenge each other, but we also reason about what reason is and challenge each other, and the goal is to end up in the same place. And the absolutely credible, that's credibility with a capital T, which no further experience can change for science, is always in the future. We settle for credibility in the present. Credibility with a small t. This is one of my favorite William James's quotations. We have to live today by what truth we can get today, and be ready tomorrow to call it falsehood. Ptolemaic astronomy, Euclidean space, Aristotelian logic, scholastic metaphysics were expedient for centuries. But human experience has boiled over those limits, and we now call these things only relatively true, or true within those borders of experience. Absolutely, they are false. And if we were, and this is written in 1900, so since then we could add Newtonian mechanics being replaced by quantum mechanics, and we could replace Darwin's evolutionary tree of life with the web of life, because at the microbiological level, there is horizontal gene transfer going on all the time between microbes. Okay, so this is credible knowledge then. We start out with the individual researcher's existential me here and now, and we end up with the scientific community's intersubjective, anyone, anywhere, anytime. We go from claim to credible discovery, a textbook fact. Okay. So this is, that sort of finishes the first two-thirds of what I was going to talk about. Now we have another third. This is Michel Montaigne's chateau near Saint-Emilion in France. This is an aerial view. This is a picture that I took. This over here is where Montaigne used to hang out, and this is where his wife used to hang out. I don't know what they used the main building for. But this is where Montagne had his library of about 5,000 volumes or something like that, which is not bad in the 16th century, and wrote his famous essays. And in his essays, he asks the question in old French, qu'est-ce que je? Okay, which we would say, qu'est-ce que je? Now, what do I know? And I was always very impressed with these essays, and when thinking about science, how do you know that this process that I just described to you is real? How about other kinds of ways of knowing things? Why is science better or different or not as good as other ways of knowing? So that's what the last chapter of Everyday Practice of Science is about. It's about what I call faith, more than one way to practice the world, which already is trying to generate controversy through that chapter. So the answer, of course, about science is that we believe in science because of technology. Because it works. Empirical evidence shows we've populated and changed the world. And so technology is good. And Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, our famous Benjamin Franklin, said, when agriculture is improved, trade enlarged, the arts have made living made more easy and comfortable, and of course the happiness of mankind, humankind it should be now, promoted, knowledge then becomes really useful. So that way we can tell knowledge is useful because of all those things that happened. But we have to deal with, if we're going to be philosophically consistent, we have to deal with the British empiricists and with David Hume. And David Hume said, what assurance do we have beyond immediate sense experience and memories for our existence? Try proving you exist somehow. Or matters of fact. The belief that the course of nature will continue uniformly the same, we take for granted without any proof. So Einstein and many others have answered you. Here's what Einstein says. We have faith in the possibility that the regulations valid for the world of existence are rational, that is comprehensible to reason. So I call this intelligible design. Not to be mistaken with intelligent design. Intelligible design means faith in the intelligibility of the way the world is and how it works. So, but that sounds a little like religion. In fact, my friends at work accuse me of equating science with religion. So this is William James's generic definition of religion. In the broadest sense, it is belief in an unseen order and belief that the individual supreme good lies in adjusting oneself to that order. And James says, this works whether you believe in one God, many gods, or no God. Do you believe in an unseen order? And you believe that the good life is to adjust yourself to that order? That's what James says is the broadest possible definition of religion. So for science, the truth of the unseen order is the possibility of understanding the way things are. Only that possibility. And credibility then, or truth with a small t, is knowledge about the way things are. For religion, the truth of the unseen order are core beliefs about how we believe things are. And then credibility becomes the question of how to harmoniously adjust oneself to that unseen order. So people who have particular religious beliefs very rarely end up critiquing their own religious beliefs, but within their community will end up arguing with each other about how best to, you know, apply those beliefs to everyday life. We saw that happen recently with Jimmy Carter, who left the Southern Baptist Convention because he disagreed not with the basic ideas of the religiosity of the Baptist Convention, but he disagreed with the way it was being applied and interpreted with respect to women. So, how does that for instance, compare intelligible design then with intelligent design. So here's an interesting analogy. In 1759, developmental biologists could not explain how a single cell could become a whole organism. They had no clue. In 1992, it's claimed that evolutionary biology can't account for the common ancestry of all life forms. And those who believe this call this irreducible complexity. So in 1759, a hypothetical force was introduced to explain how this happened. It was called the vis essentiality, essentialis. And a hypothetical force was introduced in 1992. It was called intelligent design. So the supporters here understand the vis essentialis as a placeholder, truth with a small t, requiring further investigation. But here, the supporters understand intelligent design as not requiring further investigation. They know the truth of the designer for them, the ones who believe in intelligent design. It's God. So, 250 years goes by, and now biomedical research provides the contemporary account of development that replaces the vis essentialis. But having faith in the truth of the matter ends research and situates intelligent design, no matter how important it is as a religious idea, and whether it's correct or not, outside of science, and of course, outside the science classroom. So, but if your religion, so if your religion requires six literal days of creation, then it clashes with science. But it's important to ask what happens about other kinds of claims. So, for instance, this is one of my favorite Emily Dickinson stanza from one of her poems. A color stands abroad on solitary hills that science cannot overtake, but human nature feels. So the question is, well, are there things that science cannot overtake that human nature can really feel? So here's an example of what happens in bioethics, an area where I work. This is a book put out by the European Network of Cooperation relating to bioethics, where they have 120 case studies regarding bioethical issues presented from six points of view: Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, and agnostic. And in addition, international law and secular ethics. Each of these points of view can provide a basis for a reasoned set of arguments about how to deal with the issues that are raised. But they're all different. So whenever you start out with specific sets of revelations or assumptions or balancing orders, then one can end up with reasoned frameworks based upon those assumptions. But here's an interesting turnaround that's one that influences me. There is a radical secularist approach to bioethics that is expressed by a philosopher, a guy who's actually chairman of philosophy at Princeton, and one really good place to read about it is in his book, Practical Ethics. And what Singer says is that we should begin our analysis of ethics with conscious disavowal that members of our own species have any special worth or inherent value because they are members of our species. It's an interesting claim. That Singer's work is actually the basis, at least philosophical basis, for the animal liberation. Okay, but also Singer would not be all that opposed to infanticide or dealing with physician-assisted suicide or other things for ending life, because he doesn't necessarily view those lives from his perspective as having any special worth aside from their rational and interconnected possibilities of interacting with other people. So here's another view, and this is ethical humanism. And this is belief in the supreme worth or sanctity of human life And those people who are ethical humanists, who sort of write about it, say that this is a religious faith, without obligations or beliefs about the supernatural. So I end up in this debate between Singer and ethical humanism, actually feeling more comfortable with ethical humanism than with radical secularism. This is sort of a scientific view, and this is a religious view. But here, I don't know about some other things, but here, intelligent design, intelligible design, I clearly come down on the side of intelligible design. But when it comes to ethical humanism versus radical secularism, I tend to come down on the side of ethical humanism. So here's what I take as the situation. And that is that, this is my rock analogy, which I borrowed from somebody. I don't know where I got it from. I'm hoping someday somebody will tell me where it came from. So you're walking on a beach, you see a boulder, a big rock, and you think to yourself, what kind of rock is this? How did it get here? Or what can be done with it? Or you can think to yourself, what does it mean that this rock and I are sharing this beach together at this moment in time? What can this moment or rock teach me about the meaning of life? And I claim that these are both questions that are unavoidable for that encounter. But this is the question of science, and this is the question of religion. So this is sort of the, this is the last slide. So the way I think about this is that we start out with everyday life experience, and we split it into the scientific and religious attitudes. One gives us the anywhere, anytime intersubjectivity, and the other gives us this sort of unseen order and adjustment there too. But try as we might, and notwithstanding claims in the literature to the contrary, I don't think they can stay separate. I think every one of us has to integrate these views back together. Now, we may decide, for instance, if I'm an atheist, I may, I can still, that's a view about the unseen order, and I can come up with various interpretations about that, including being real comfortable with secular, the secular ethics of Peter Singer. But in the end, the knowledge of the self and the world comes back to integrating for each of us, those interactions. So I think when we think about science and religion that way, it seems to me it's a little bit different than the way they're typically opposed to each other, but maybe not. Anyway, thank you all for your attention, and I'd be happy to... Okay, we're going to take a few questions. I would ask, please, to ask the question. And don't pontificate. And I reserve the right to cut you off if you do. And we're at 10 or 15 minutes? It's fine. Terrific. Okay, it's Ryan.
Okay, well, this distinction between Singer's attitude, no value on humans above other animals, and the humanist one, where you regard all humans equally, but you don't say too much about animals. I think both of these neglect a fundamental aspect of human nature, and that is that we have an evolved nature that has arisen from millions of years of living as a certain species, and that we have, genetically produced unconscious tendencies to feel close relationships to those that we know and have encountered and grown up with, and that, and therefore, we are basically, I have these tendencies to want to associate and to feel sympathy and to take care of the people we know much more than the people we don't know. And so I think that tells us that we should care much more about the people we interact with than the ones we don't, and certainly we interact much more with people than we do with animals. So I feel that on the basis of our history as human species or primate species, we can make some statements about which of those two possibilities is more consistent with the way the world is. Actually, though, one runs into the naturalistic fallacy that the way the world is doesn't necessarily tell us the way we ought to behave. And Roy O'Brew, I don't know if you're familiar with his book, but he says that what religion does is tell us, first of all, gives us a framework for understanding the way the world is, and secondly, it tells us what's important for us for our behavior. And I didn't hear you talk much about how you decide the value of what's important.
Well, first, let me just say that I think that your initial comments are exactly right. We are evolutionary creatures, and how we think about these things in terms of our common experience influences and probably determines to a large extent our sympathies. And the value, to me, of Singer versus ethical humanism is just the polarity that it helps define.
Right.
Okay, because sometimes it's good to define things in totally polar ways, because when you get the shades of gray in the middle, you get to the point where you can't tell things apart. But there you can really tell them that they're way, way apart. I didn't really talk about the conventional positive notion about religion and science is that science tells us what we can do, and religion tells us what we should do.
Right.
But you can sort of say that they don't have to interact. And so I want to sort of argue that they can't escape each other. But I'll just make one interesting comment about that. And there's this famous Einstein clause that religion, that science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind. If you think about that, it's backwards. Okay? Because he writes a lot of places about how religion teaches us what we should do. In which case, you should say, science without religion is blind. It doesn't know what to do, and religion without science is lame. It can't accomplish its goals. But that's not his sentence. It's the opposite. And so I think there are two different really interesting things going on there for me that need to be integrated. But I think you're right about both of them. I agree with both of the things that you said.
Okay, Rob, can you speak to a little bit about, let's say, a scientist makes a discovery, and now the substantiation of that of other scientists. And so often, to me, it seems like that discovery might be a proclivity or a tendency, more of the relative truth versus the absolute truth. Can you talk about the difficulties in dealing with those shades of gray in science research?
Well, it again comes back to what works when you get out into the real world. So in my laboratory, we discovered that a protein called fibronectin is a biological glue. And we discovered that skin cells migrate much better when they have that glue than when they don't. And so based upon those observations, and other people who did the experiments could repeat those observations. Well, now you say, well, so what? And we came up with the idea that maybe the reason why people who have wounds that don't heal don't have that glue in. So then we finally tried to use that stuff and treat wounds to see if it can make them better. So at some point or another, the science is always potentially an artifact of the conditions under which you do the experiments. And eventually, to make it real, you have to bring it into the world. It has to affect me. It has to affect the world or affect people. It has to be shown, ultimately, to have an interaction. Once that happens, then I think that it becomes more believable. But until that happens, it's a negotiation. Because if you're important and you send a paper in to a good journal, it's much more likely to be accepted that appear not important. Doesn't mean the work's not as good. It just means we're elitists. And science is a very elite a form of knowledge. So there's constantly, you know, there's another aspect of the work that came from that fiber reduction work that actually is relevant to the people and who we are. So good things came out of it, but it wasn't initially what we expected. So there's no way of predicting what will happen in that interaction between scientists as they try to convince each other. But there's a lot of politics. Can't avoid politics. And there's a lot of competition.
And there's more failure than success.
And in the lab, there's always more failure and success. But when you see a paper, you don't see the failures. Because unless it's a certain kind of government-funded research where all the results have to be reported, which is very atypical. Now, in general, you report the results that you think are the ones that most honestly reflect the outcome. So you take 10 notebooks of data collected over 2 years, and you compress it into 10 figures and an 8-page paper. And so what happened to those 10 notebooks? Well, most of it, it's gone. Now, it's in the notebooks. If somebody wants to come see it, they ought to be able to come see it. But I had to pick what I thought it meant. What I think is the real data, and then other people, you know, see what happens.
Great. Earlier, when you covered intelligent design, I don't know if they said that they believed God and they didn't investigate any more of that. I don't know if you're aware, but they include in that underdog design people who believe in transference. This is the idea that it was seeded from some other galaxy or some other civilization, and that would start to be an exception to the God thing. Now, so of course, they are doing experiments on that, or
yeah, I don't know. The scientific claim underlying intelligent design is what's called irreducible complexity. And irreducible complexity is a statistical analysis of the way things are relative to the starting point where they might have come from, and says that there's no way of getting from A to B through natural processes. And there's no way of ever explaining that. So I guess, you know, saying that you could either have God do it or it could come from outer space would be, but that sort of, what do they call that, recursive? Because if it came from outer space, you'd have to say where that came from. So I think that at least the folks that I know and who I've talked to and spent time with do intelligent design, are pretty much people who, you know, really believe firmly, and who knows, maybe they're right, that the God didn't evolve that.
Okay. As a secular humanist, I have to go with Peter Singer. Because, you know, like Jay Gould points out, you know, it took it to magisterials. Your intelligible design does not allow a repeatable experiment that I can follow to verify what you said. You or James or anybody else, just pick it out of the air. Give me an experiment, a data that I can repeat so that I can develop this religious attitude and know that there is an unseen order. How do you know that there is an unseen order? What evidence do you have?
What Bob is saying is really, really important. He's saying, how do you know that there's an unseen order? And I don't. And a lot of people don't believe there's an unseen order.
Thank you.
What James says is that if you believe that there's an unseen order, and if you believe that the good life is adapting yourself to that order, then you're behaving in a religious fashion. Okay? So that's what James says. So you don't have, there doesn't have to be one, but if you believe there is one, and the purpose of this, the previous slide, it's easier to demonstrate it, is to emphasize that there are a lot of questions that we end up asking as folks, as individuals, as humans, for which there are no testable answers. They are only questions that we can ask in the context of our own belief systems. And that belief system is then becomes, for me, what our unseen order is. So, if you believe, as Bob is saying, that there is no unseen order, that is your unseen order. Okay? That is your unseen order. Because there's no reason that you should believe that there's no unseen order or that there is an unseen order. So that's the point that I'm trying to make. That you have to make a commitment in order to make a decision. And to make that commitment, you have to start out with your own personal set of beliefs, which may come from evolution,
which has nothing to do with science.
Well, it does. The history of science is a history of highly successful results from believing there's an unseen order and investigating it. And the reason why we have 6 billion people on this planet today rather than 6 million chimpanzees in the wild is because we've been exploring this unseen order and it works and it makes us capable of laughing narcissism.
But it's not intersubjective, it's strictly subjective.
I think the point that Bob is making, that it's not intersubjective, that it's strictly subjective, is also exactly right. Each person has to make these decisions for himself. Of course it's not science, it's religion. But we have to do it. We can't avoid doing it.
You have to do it, I don't.
Okay, David. I think one of the sticking points here, Fred, is the use of the word religion. Perhaps if we said philosophy instead. In fact, the second sentence there really is philosophical. It has to do with meaning, reason, purpose. In my book, I said that, you know, science kind of has hit a blank wall, you know, that science has nothing, no question about or no concern about purpose or reason or why things are. They just describe things, period. And so scientists have to become philosophical, and philosophers have stopped being philosophers. They have to be more scientific. But perhaps, you know, tell me what you think, you know, religion, you know, an unseen order, if we could get rid of that word, it's got so many connotations. Quote Einstein, and I remember I reported exactly what he said, something like, ask if he was religious, and he said, in the sense that I observe the awesomeness of the universe and how everything works so exquisitely, and in that sense, I am religious. You mean religion in that sense, or philosophical?
So,
an unseen order gets to be mystical type of stuff.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are very spiritual, and for them, what I'm trying to do is understand something about human experience and human nature, and religion is something that makes up something important for a lot of people. So I could let us, those of us who are more or less agnostic, off the hook and say, well, it's not religion, it's philosophy. But I don't want to do that. I want to sort of challenge the community and say, we all make religious decisions, even if we don't want to call them religious. We all decide what for us counts as the unseen order, even if it is that there is no unseen order. And we end up having to decide how to live our lives. Science doesn't tell us how to live our lives. Now, you know, you're right, that is philosophy. And it's not necessarily science or religion. And so, you know, but I don't want to just, throw it in as philosophy. I think it's more fun and more legitimate to call it religion and to create the dialogue. And you know,
why does there have to be a meaning?
Well, there doesn't have to be a meaning for you, but for some people, they want a meaning.
Because you can't answer why. You can only answer what, where, how, and when. That's what science does.
Well, that's what science does.
Answers why.
We need more than that.
Okay, we're going to have three more questions.
Three.
You got four.
So, yeah, but we only have time for four questions. A couple of circles.
One, element science, I have a huge problem with that. Should be government science, I think government is religion, we can plan this for thousands of years in science. I can prove you're wrong, you're out, right? There is no, I have a problem if you say politics and science. I'm not saying that, you know, we don't have to say it's wrong. If you think it's wrong, then government science?
No, it has to be. I mean, just think about, like, so for instance, for years and years, 19th century scientists believed in the ether. That everything was going through the ether. And then you have the Michelson-Morley experiment that disproves the ether. And for the next 40 years, they keep arguing about whether or not the experiment was done properly. The problem is that it, because of what I said back at the beginning, because every experiment tests an idea, but also tests the experimental design to test the idea, that if you believe in something, you can discount what people who get results, you can discount their results if they oppose your beliefs on the basis that their experiment was not done properly.
Well, somebody else can do the experiment. You'll be relegated to nowhere if you keep showing up with goofy results.
Well, you say that, but if you sit down and you read, let's say, the last 20 years history of Nobel laureate recognition speeches, you see the same theme over and over again. And that's the theme that I presented at the beginning in the lecture, that so-and-so had to overcome the dogma of nobody believing in them and had to fight against unbelievable odds in order to get the community to see things the way they finally saw things.
But they did. They got the community.
Well, yeah, but it takes a long time. And so 23 years. I mean, that's the whole issue.
Okay, the gentleman on the back row back there.
I want to go back to your subtitle where you mentioned confusion. Do you think you can explain this whole science versus religion issue from the perspective of instinct versus intuition?
Instinct versus intuition?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I'd have to think about that. You'd have to explain to me better what you
mean. Do you think being religious is intuitive? Or you can phrase being scientific is instinctive?
Yeah, I don't know about either of those, but I know that there's a guy named Michael Russo I'm friendly with, and he imagines the following thing. He talks about instinct and religion.